You're listening to Radio Berkman from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. You can find show notes for this episode and more programs like this at blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman.
Do you hear the news? I'm going to make records.
No kidding.
You cannot work all day at McDonald's and come home and make better music than if you devoted your whole entire professional waking life to learning about music, learning the craft, practicing, all of the things that go into songwriting in particular.
How do you become a professional musician? We can probably say a part of being a professional musician is getting paid for the work, but the digital revolution has posed a threat to a few significant sources of an artist's revenue. Illegal downloading and copying is, of course, one of the threats most often cited, but digital sampling and licensing is another. Musicians and their publishers typically earn a royalty anytime a piece of a song they wrote or performed is used in another way, on movies or television, or as a sample in a remix or new song. But how do you deal with permission and compensation if you have $0 and want to remix the work of hundreds of artists? Or what about uploading a fan-created music video to YouTube for which you earn nothing? Real-life examples like these just go to show that sampling and licensing is still a fairly murky territory in the digital age, and some feel that the music industry needs to be better heard. Jay Rosenthal is the general counsel for the National Music Publishers Association, with decades of experience working with music industry organizations on the legal side, and representing artists like Salt-N-Pepa, Thievery Corporation, and Mary Chapin Carpenter. I asked him where artists need advocacy in the digital age.
Artists need advocacy in absolutely every area. They are besieged on all sides. On the one side, in the business world, they must sign deals with companies, record labels, producers, managers. On the music publishing side, as if they're songwriters, with publishing companies, with administrators, they must deal with radio that is very oppressive to especially performing artists. They are besieged by those in the copyright world who try to limit their rights in certain ways. They are besieged on the road by promoters and venue owners who, if you're a very small artist and starting artist, you might not even be paid for your performances. Everywhere they look, they are being besieged, and the most dispiriting aspect of this is in the past 15 years or so, the fans themselves have become somewhat antagonistic, if not outright enemies of the artist's interest. When artists stand up for their rights, the first people to generally attack them, especially when they're dealing with issues of piracy, are their fans. That has been very disconcerting to artists, that they're recognizing that their fans are very much loving their art, but not so loving of the artist. You know, where do they need advocacy? Absolutely every place that you can see.
Well, it feels like the ground is constantly shifting underneath the artist's feet because, for one, the new technology is always coming in and disrupting the old models. And so only the most nimble or the most well-funded of artists can take advantage of it. And, you know, artists generally, I mean, they're a very diverse group. There's a large number of them, and some of them have different interests than others. How do you bring this coalition together of disparate artists and have them sing with one voice?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think there are many, tentacles to that particular issue. There are old artists and there are young artists. There are artists who have made it. There are artists who, quote unquote, have not yet made it. There are artists who can tour, and there are artists who are ill and can't tour. I think that as a general matter, if you're, looking at the issue of technology, technology is the best of all worlds and the worst of all worlds. It comes along and allows artists to really change their business models, and they try to adapt as best they can. I think that many artists have understood that many of the roles that the record companies and even the publishers and managers have done over the years are now on them to do, communicating with their fans, for instance. And that's a great aspect of new technology, you know, and social networking. You can really, you know, reach out to your community. You can create your community much better and easier. At the same time, you know, the internet and the technology that has come along and the attitudes that have come along with it have decimated the industry and the artist in ways that most people do not recognize, and really some of them don't even want to recognize. One of the problems, I think, is staying on top of the new technologies. They come so fast. Nobody even said these words, you know, 15 years ago. You know, who knew Google? Who knew Amazon.com? You know, and all of these services that are now getting into the distribution, whether it's the streaming or downloading of music, and therefore how artists get paid from that, all of a sudden becomes significant. It never used to be. You know, whoever knew a ringtone would be an issue, you know, 20 years ago? You know, nobody even knew what the hell that was, you know, and all of a sudden, ringtones are important enough so that the Copyright Royalty Board established a royalty rate for a compulsory license for ringtones. The biggest fear amongst artists, and I'll tell you, the biggest fear amongst songwriters, is that we're turning from a world of professionals into a world of amateurs. And I've represented artists for 25 years. I do not believe in this idea that, you know, well, you know, amateur music, everybody will make music, or there's more music now than ever. Well, you know, the quality of the music isn't going to be, you know, much better. It's going to be much worse if you're an amateur. And there's going to be a lot of people getting out of the business, you know, per se, because of this, and they already have.
Well, every artist starts off as an amateur. What's the difference, I guess? Kind of a naive question.
No, that's a very good question, actually. You know, a professional, just like any other professional, it becomes a profession, meaning that you've got to learn not just your craft, but how to do it and to make money from it, so that you can continue to do it and you can continue to get better. In the copyright, the constitutional provision deals with the issue of progress. You know, what is progress, effectively? There are some people who feel that, well, progress is creating new technologies. That's not the way I view it. Progress under the copyright law is giving incentive to artists to make better and better music so that our culture is better and better and people are making money from it so that they can do it professionally. It is not just a hobby. You cannot work all day at McDonald's and come home and make better music than if you devoted your whole entire professional waking life to learning about music, learning the craft, practicing, all of the things that go into songwriting in particular. You know, and if you ask the songwriters, you know, like, what's harder, performing or songwriting? I think most of them will say songwriting. One of my first clients in this business was a country artist who I represented when she was just starting out, a little folk artist in Washington, Mary Chapin Carpenter. And she had a full-time job during the day, and her manager came along and said, you know, let's do a management deal, and I negotiated a management deal with this manager. And the first thing he did was to go out there to get a publishing deal for her where she got paid a stipend. And that stipend on a monthly basis allowed her to stop work, that she was working at a nonprofit in Washington, D.C. And it was a tough job. She would put in 12-hour days at this. But she was a fantastic songwriter, and the potential was there. If he didn't get that money for her, for the publishing company, to allow her to write her songs, that first couple of albums of hers would have gone nowhere. And she would have never had a career. But she had the ability to sit every day and hone her craft and punch out some of the greatest songs that, for a few years, made her you know, the top female country artist in the world. And it would not have been possible if she had to work full time. And that's the difference between taking it from a hobby level to a level that is glorious.
There've been a number of artists who've taken the digital music revolution in one direction of reforming their own personal business model. They've decided to release their music for free or for low cost or for name your price. I know one artist who we've spoken to who actually doesn't sell his music at all. He just puts it out on file sharing networks. I wonder if there's a middle ground between the folks who would say that what they're doing is short-sighted and is diminishing the possibilities for other artists, and the argument that this is the wave of the future and everybody's going to have to be doing this.
Yeah. I don't think it's when you talk about these new, you know, the models of giving music away, this is not new. This is, and I don't think it's at all contrary to what an artist rights movement is all about. The core of artist rights and the future of what artists do is that they have at least the decision making power to do that, to give your music away for free. If an artist wants to give their music away for free as a promotional tool, God bless them. It's their choice, and that's their business model. You know, I remember a band that I represented that signed to Geffen Records, and you know, they were like, it came to me and said, "Yeah, we're giving our music away, and it's all great, and everybody's downloading us for free and all that, and we're, you know, doing some shows, and you know, but eventually one day, you know, we got to stop downloading for free." And we basically told them, "Don't think it works that way. You know, once it starts and it's out there, it's pretty much out there." And you know, they actually lost their deal because they were downloaded too much. So yeah, it's a great idea. And it's great to have that promotional, you know, power. But at the end of the day, you still have to make money, or you go down the road of it being a hobby. So I'm not against artists from, you know, giving away their music for free. They can create whatever business model that they want. I just don't know of any artist who has continually given away their music for free who has not at one point regretted it. Maybe in the beginning of their career, they're fine and it's helping them. But there's a moment where the return isn't where they really wanted it to be. And then that's where you get into, well, why can't I turn the spigot off? Why can't I do something else, you know, to do it? Now, if you're talking about Radiohead and you're talking about bands that want to experiment, and that I'm not against that experimenting. I'm not convinced Radiohead's model is good. But I think experimenting with these new business models is the only thing artists can do at this point, is experiment. You know, it's that or close up shop and go home and start working at the bar again, or go to law school. You know, which a lot of, you know, every music lawyer, by the way, is a frustrated musician. I mean, you know, that's the bottom line. You know, things are so bad that if you don't experiment, then you might as well pack it in right at the beginning of your career.
You're listening to Radio Berkman. The song you hear behind me is Linda Lindell's 1968 hit, What a Man. But you might recognize it better as this. That's the 1993 chart topper What a Man by Salt-N-Pepa and En Vogue, which borrowed its sound and lyrical hook from Lindell's hit. Jay Rosenthal represented Salt-N-Pepa and helped license samples for this song. Sampling has become much more prevalent since. They say they never really miss you till you dead or you gone. So on that note, I'm leaving after the song. So you ain't gotta. DJ Danger Mouse skyrocketed to popularity in 2004 by mashing up rapper Jay-Z's Black Album with music from the Beatles' White Album. And in 2010, Greg Gillis, also known as the remix artist Girl Talk, released the free 70-plus minute album, All Day, which was composed of at least 373 samples, none of which Gillis used legally, though no one has asked Gillis to stop. I asked Rosenthal about the difference between licensed and unlicensed sampling and whether this practice hurts musicians.
I see, on a certain level, no problem at all with the business that's set up right now where you have to clear your samples. And I differentiate to a certain extent between samples and of the musical composition clearances, which I think are of a different nature than the sampling of the performances, which is what, you know, that's where you start from. You know, you then deal with the musical composition clearance. But I think it's of a totally different nature, and I am much more against sampling of sound recordings without authority than I am about interpolations of older songs and possibly, you know, working them in. And I've worked on with especially Salt-N-Pepa. They went in and they worked out the deals. I worked out the deals as part of this to make sure that everybody, all the original artists, all the original songwriters and the new songwriters that added parts to it and the new performers, all of them had a piece of the pie, and it turned into one of the greatest hip-hop anthems of all time. And let's look at artist rights. What is artist rights? It is the right to get paid, it is the right to approve the use of your music, and it is the right of attribution. That's the three cores of artist rights. The use of samples, especially by Girl Talk, violates every one of those. And basically, it is not building on another artist's work, it is making your new work on the backs of older artists. And there are some awful, awful stories that I know of personally and I've been involved in of older artists who have been sampled and didn't have the ability to fight for any kind of piece of the pie, and that they basically were exploited and oppressed by this act. I think what Girl Talk does is horrible. I think it's horrible. Like what Danger Mouse did with the Grey album. I don't believe that is an art form that can sustain itself under any moral umbrella of any kind. It is not culture. It is not just to say that, I am just going to take something from, I'm going to take two albums and I'm going to mash them together. And putting aside the aesthetics, putting aside whether it's good or not, I'm not saying that it doesn't sound good. If you ask the old musicians, about drugs, they'll say, the problem with heroin isn't that it feels bad. The problem with heroin is it feels good. When you're taking it, you're flying, and the same thing here. It may sound good, but, scratch the surface a little bit and you've got a really rancid scenario of people's rights, older artists' rights being trampled. And like I'm getting back to the point of how many enemies can older artists have? And until they just throw their arms up and say, fuck it, I'm going to do something else. That's not what the copyright law is about. It's incentive to create. And if you know that your work's going to be out there used by other people and you're not going to get paid for it, that doesn't sound like good incentive to me. We look at the pyramids, and the pyramids are beautiful. And also we recognize from archaeological studies that hundreds of thousands of people died making them. I would rather not have the pyramid knowing that hundreds of thousands of people died. I'd rather have those people alive. And I would rather not have rap and hip hop, even though that's my career. I cut my career on hip hop music in all forms and go-go music from Washington, D.C., which was, by the way, a source of many samples, unauthorized samples taken by the hip hop producers from New York who used to come down to Washington to listen to the go-go bands and basically take that music and then, put it into their works. I feel that digital sampling is a clear violation of the original artist's rights unless the artist is involved in approving it or going down the road of somehow getting paid. And certainly getting attribution. I do like the Creative Commons idea of creating a licensing collective. If you want to give your music up to some kind of a database source or collective, agency of some kind, that whereby you agree as the artist that anyone can sample my music. That to me is fantastic. That's the artist making the decision, the original artist. And for those artists who do that, and I've got clients who have done that. Thievery Corporation has at times given tracks to this collective that says, well, go ahead, go ahead and sample. I don't care about this particular song. And you can do that. I think that is fantastic on a certain level because everyone's involved in it. The problem with sampling is, and putting aside the musical composition, again, that's a different thing. It's the person's performance. You can't get around it. You could take that performance and you could alter it, but it's still the performance. An artist's performance is an inviolable part of property of that particular performer. You cannot use somebody else's performance, whether it's a blast of a trumpet by Maynard Ferguson or whether it's a long track by anybody, without their authority, and think that that somehow is adding to our culture, adding to our work. There are some people who believe that copyright is a human right. And I think that, that those people, their voice has been totally drowned out in this debate over human rights. In Europe, there are moral rights. There are no moral rights over here, per se, for music. And in Europe, they would look at the use of a digital sample used by a new artist in a way that the original artist felt was disparaging to them as actionable in a court of law. And I totally agree with that. The old producers, the hip-hop producers, many of them try to, today, make this argument that, oh, we were making a new art form. When, in fact, most of the producers back then understood, and my clients, you know, I mean, they almost, you know, they laugh at this proposition. The reason that most sampling, especially when you're dealing with drum beats and bass lines, was done was not to create a new art form. It was because they were cheap and lazy. They didn't want to pay for a bass player to come in, and it was right there. And they were playing. Only later did they start this, you know, kind of thinking that, oh, well, this is a new art form. And we, you know, these guys are many of them are chuckling at this thought that, you know, a new art form was being created when all they were doing was, I'm going to take that track. I'm not going to pay for it. I really don't give a shit. I don't care. It's the man, you know, and that's the other thing. You know, they look at the idea that because it's a record label, that they're screwing, that's okay, because the record label screws the artist. And let me tell you, that is true. A couple of ideas, you know, compulsory licensing, a lot of problems with it, but that's a thought, although there's a lot of problems with that. I do like maybe collective licensing, a blanket license approach, but I like the idea of this this place where you can go for samples that the artists have given their music to as probably the best solution to digital sampling that's out there. And I believe that if this was done on a big basis, and I know it's been done on a smaller basis, but if it was done on a big basis, you would have you know, hundreds of thousands of tracks to choose from. At the end of the day, who the hell's going to pay for it? I don't know, but you know, it is something that is really worth thinking about. If what we're talking about is digital, you know, sampling culture is a form of art that we want to promote. It's great so long as you don't do it on the backs of old artists who never have a say in the creative process or the legal process.
Well, I think about remix artists, and there's obviously a demand for their work. But if you view a remix artist as, and you know, in the beginning, an amateur, the way you would view, you know, any other kind of performing artist, guitarist, a singer. They don't have the same kind of, because of the legal restriction, they don't have the same kind of avenue, you know, up from the amateur to the professional ranks. And the professional ranks is the only area where they are able to afford to produce their art, because the remix samples cost so much.
Yes, I think that's right. That is true.
How should a remix artist, you know, just getting started, you know, how can we, you know, encourage them?
Well, I'm not sure they need encouragement. I think they do it. They do it anyway. This has been one of the problems, is that, you know, the idea here that to promote this type of art with no restrictions and with no thinking that, well, you know what, maybe under certain circumstances, certain types of works maybe just shouldn't be made. There is nothing wrong with that. Everybody has to work under rules to ensure that somebody isn't harmed and damaged. And until we have, let's say, a place for a compulsory in any way, shape, or form, whereby the old artist is somehow either compensated or asked in any way, shape, or form, I'm not sure we want to promote what they're doing. They've got to understand that, yeah, oh, it's cool, and it's great, and it sounds good, and I can do that at home and play it, you know, and be an amateur, and I'm happy. But if you want to be in this business, if you want to actually, you know, step up to the plate and become quote unquote a professional artist, to start that road by the first thing you're doing is violating other people's rights, possibly human rights, I don't see any benefit to that whatsoever. I see that as not being progress. I see that as almost some kind of system whereby, you know, the survival of the fittest. You know, this is Darwinian almost. It's like, I want to become an artist and I'm just going to fuck everybody else to get there, including other artists, which is the worst part about it. You know, I mean, yes, it's true that many of these old records, they're owned by companies that don't pay the artists. True enough. But under every deal that's ever been entered into between an artist and a label, there is some kind of a payment to the artist. They are at the bottom of the food chain. That is true. If you screw with somebody at the top of the food chain, nothing's going to come to the bottom. If you give them a little bit of dough, hopefully something will. And this is where artist rights is also involved in making sure that artists enter into equitable deals with labels and ensure that they get paid in one way or another. A perfect example of the best way this could ever occur is Sound Exchange. And the idea that 50 cents on every dollar getting paid to Sound Exchange for a non-interactive internet radio and satellite radio gets paid directly to the artist so that it doesn't even go to the label. You know, that's the kind of structures that we need in the music business to ensure that, you know, the labels, if they get money, aren't going to be, not paying the artist in one way or another for this new use of their music. But there are rules that these young artists have to abide by, and one of them is copyright and human rights and artist rights, not just anything, moral rights, whatever it is. All of this will ensure that whatever they want to do in this business, they can do. Let's not forget, Hank Shackley, I heard 15 years ago, talk about anybody can use Public Enemy. I heard him say this at the New Music Seminar up in New York when I was attending. And 4 years later, he was suing people for digital samples. You turn, you grow, you know, you recognize that you know, yes, what I wanted at the beginning of my career and what I believed in, because it was all for one and one for all, and the world is my oyster and, you know, I can do whatever I want. As it goes down the road and you recognize that your rights are being abused by somebody else under the guise of art, that effectively at the end of the day, that's not a good thing. And then they turn around and they become people who are, you know, openly trying to stop other people from using it. We assume that many of these remixers and many of these artists who use older artist works use them in a positive way. It doesn't mean that if we have a system that allows that to happen, that it will always be used in a positive way, and it wouldn't be disparaging to the original artist or harmful to everybody. There is a Nazi record label out there. What if a Nazi record label digitally samples somebody's work and puts it in their records and under this, you know, new business model that allows this to happen? Because, you know, we want to encourage these Nazi remixers, you know, who want to spread their particular political view. We want to encourage them to become artists. So we're going to allow them to do this without authority of the original artist. That's untenable on any level. If we're going to have a system where remixers are allowed to take music and do it, we have to have a moral rights regime in the United States that will protect artists from their works being used in ways that are disparaging to them and harmful to them. It's the only equitable way to move forward, and that will put limits on what the new artists can do and how they do it. So, you know, in effect, if you're asking, like, hey, should we promote the artists? Okay, fine, let's say that, you know, we're going to let them do this. There's got to be something that protects the original artist. And I like moral rights because that's beyond the labels. That's beyond copyright. Moral rights is something that comes directly from the original artist or the original songwriter to make sure that their work isn't being used in a way that is harmful to them. Talk about, you know, a bad culture where you, you know, empower new artists to, you know, to take away rights of old is not something that I would like to be part of as a, you know, the music business.
Well, I think it's productive when you discuss it as a systemic issue as opposed to a battle between artists, because there is a potentially a legal solution for this, and you've talked about a few, Creative Commons being one of them. What are the things that are preventing the legal, the business side of the business, the music business, from being able to solidify these kinds of legal solutions and settle?
One problem here is the idea that we're going to get there through through a change in the copyright law. The idea of creating a fair use expansion is just untenable. The idea of just allowing these works to be out there and somehow protect them. I mean, even if you're looking at orphan works and things like that, is very problematic because you have too many stakeholders out there. I think that the voluntary business level way of solving these problems are the best. I get back to this idea that you have a collective of music that's given by authors that have their rights, and they pass these rights on to the collective under terms that say, I can use my music. Anyone can use it. You know, go ahead and use it. That, to me, is the best way, the quickest way, to get to a point where these remixers can take digital samples and other things and use them.
You are listening to Radio Berkman. Today's guest, Jay Rosenthal, and I discussed the DMCA, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, passed in 1998, which in part requires that if a copyright holder discovers their work is used without permission online and they want it removed, they have to issue a takedown notice. I asked Jay how the DMCA should be reformed, and how a less tech-savvy justice system is still trying to figure out what the heck the digital revolution is all about. One of the things that you've argued for is a reform of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, the DMCA. What is the DMCA, and how have conditions changed with the growth of the internet that really necessitates a change to the law?
Yeah, I think that's a very good question. I think the problem with DMCA now and the way it's being interpreted by the courts is that it has put the whole onus of policing the internet on the copyright owner and nothing on the copyright user. I think there's got to be more balance in that context, so that basically it's not good enough to say that, oh, well, like Google. Google says we got a great system of takedown. Fine, they do. You send a Google notice takedown if it's very specific and all, well, you can get it taken down. Well, it can go right back up, and then you got to send another notice, and then it can go right back up again, and you got to send another notice. Really, what the DMCA is turning into is incredibly anti-indie artist and indie label. At the end of the day, the big companies can deal with the takedown notices like Viacom and all these. Small labels can't. It's interesting. One of my clients actually has such a good community of fans that now they have the fans telling them when stuff's up there. And then they kind of react to them. They've got their like little street team out there of folks who tell them, well, you know, we saw this on this, and then they'll send a takedown notice. They couldn't do that on their own. They don't have enough money to pay people to do that. Nobody understood when they passed the DMCA how much material would be up in the internet. So my sense is that there's got to be a movement towards joint responsibility. The ISPs, the services, they've got to have some kind of a program, of system, of filtering, of something that where they are actively involved in stopping the distribution of unauthorized copyrighted material. I think the courts are misinterpreting the DMCA. It just needs to be interpreted in a better way. I think a lot of judges are getting it wrong, not tremendously, but significantly. In this area of shared responsibility, you know, there's a part of the DMCA, for instance, that talks about a copyright user must react if there is a red flag of usage, meaning that, hey, if you know that this particular party that's using your service is engaged in a lot of copyright infringement, you have reason to believe that, it's time to step in. You know, well, the courts have not addressed that as a responsibility as much as I think the original drafters of the DMCA wanted them to. I think we've got a generation of law clerks that are influencing our judges, and maybe rightly so. That's really what they're for to a large extent. You know, these guys are younger, and they're just out of law school, and they're supposed to bring that kind of experience. But with this, we're talking about older judges who just have no clue as to the technology. Many of them, you know, they think of music and it's like, you know, Mantovani, and, you know, and they don't think of it in terms of rappers and remixes and all of the issues that are facing artists today. If you look at the Grokster case had three opinions effectively. There was the opinion of the court, and then you had two concurring opinions, one written by Ginsburg and one written by Breyer. And you look through, you know, you're reading the Breyer concurring opinion. which is a different approach than Ginsberg. Breyer is much more, I think, pro-technological innovation. Ginsberg is more, you know, protective of copyright per se. In the middle of Breyer's opinion, he quotes Wilco.
Hmm.
Out of the blue.
That's great.
Do you think that in any way, shape, or form, Stephen Breyer ever heard of the band Wilco before his clerk told him about it? What can I say? You know, I mean, we have to be very vigilant about making sure that in law schools there is an even-handed approach to the teaching of this material, so that, you know, one leaves law school not thinking that, well, you know, copyright's wrong, we've got to push it back, but understanding that, well, there's problems with copyright, but you know what? There's also something called moral rights and artist rights. And, it, you know, there are two sides to this story that need to be balanced in a real way. I think we're a little out of balance at this point with most.
How do you discover new music just as a fan? And what is, you know, one artist that has stood out to you that most recently that you've discovered?
I listen to my son. he knows more about new music than anyone I know. And for the last 5 or 6 years, I've taken him with me to South by Southwest every year. And I let him go through and find the bands online, which they have a great system at South by Southwest to, like, hear the bands that are playing there. It was like 2,000 of them. And a couple of years ago, this is a great example of how you find new music. He got online and he saw a couple of shows. And he said, let's go to the Japan night, which is all bands from Japan that were paid to get here by the Japanese government. And he said, there's a band I think we should see. And I would have never, ever gone to see this band, but it was a band called Pistol Valve. 13-member all-girl ska band. They come out in these wild outfits, and all of a sudden you're listening to, like, you know, English Beat, the ska stuff, the Pie Tasters. They were just phenomenal. And I think that I have gone back to Japan Night every year. So if you're asking me where do I want to see new music, I go to Japan Night at South by Southwest. But, you know, that has led me. Going to South by Southwest and listening to my son has led me to bands like Black Joe Lewis and the Honey Bears, for instance. The Carolina Chocolate Drops. That just, I would have never, ever, you know, going to see them, but for my son who masters the internet and masters new music and who guides me along. I know that doesn't help anybody else. It's just me. So really, my experience is not the common experience of new music. I get it from my clients as well as through my son. If it was up to me, you know, I'd still be listening to The Grateful Dead every night.
Well, Jay Rosenthal, thank you very much.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Jay Rosenthal is the general counsel for the National Music Publishers Association. The Rethink Music Conference is coming up on April 25th in Boston. This episode has been part of a series of podcasts about the future of music leading up to the conference. You can find out more about that at rethink-music.com or visit our website, blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman. This episode of Radio Berkman was produced by me, Daniel Dennis Jones, with help from Amr Asher, Chris Babbitts, and Alan Bargfried from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Yeah,